This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Today's economic policy four-letter word, T-A-X-E-S. What the Republican Party has in mind from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In New York City, one more time today, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, the 27th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have arrived, ladies and gentlemen, at tax day here in tax week for the American economy. As promised, congressional Republicans in the White House took the wraps off their plans for the American tax code today. More details than before, certainly, but it's more broad brush than deeply detailed. President Trump went to Indianapolis today to do the bully pulpit thing.
Over the next few months, the House and Senate will build on this framework and produce legislation that will deliver more jobs, higher pay, and lower taxes for middle-class families, for the working man and woman, and for businesses of all sizes.
We are going to take tax policy head-on today and over the next couple of months, starting with this question. How do you get from promises about this?
More jobs.
And this?
Higher pay.
And this,
and lower taxes,
to the actual thing. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going with the tax change big picture.
The tax plan is kind of like one of those crazy diets that makes big promises. Eat all the ice cream you want and still lose those pounds.
As someone who is really devoted to ice cream sundaes, I really wish that were true.
Besides being an ice cream lover, Jared Bernstein was an economist in the Obama administration. He says the GOP's all-you-can-cut tax plan wouldn't lead to more jobs and bigger paychecks. Lowering the corporate tax rate to 20% would give companies more money. But Bernstein says they're already sitting on piles of cash.
So if they wanted to expand and invest and create jobs, they would be doing it.
As far as tax fairness goes, Bernstein says even the proposed doubling of the standard deduction wouldn't help the lowest income families. But Douglas Holtz Aiken, former economic advisor to Senator John McCain, says actually the plan does make things fairer by simplifying the tax system. And while the U.S. wouldn't exactly be a tax haven, Holtz Aiken says a corporate tax cut would help.
Headquarters companies will no longer leave. Other companies will want to be here.
Creating those promised jobs and higher paychecks. But there's another player here, Congress. So all these tax plan promises
sort of put the cart before the horse here.
That's Henrietta Trays at Veda Partners. She says under Senate budget rules, the GOP tax plan can't add to the deficit for more than 10 years.
Once you get into year 11, you need to have the deficit go back to zero from where you started.
Meaning after 10 years, some of these tax cuts would have to go. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
One of the reasons the GOP has been so reluctant to share the details of its tax plan, secretive, you might often say, is that House and Senate Republicans knew that once even the slightest details of the thing were out, the rush would be on, the lobbying rush to protect this deduction or that, and the messaging rush to spin those details such as they are this way or that. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains the power of framing an economic and political proposal as big as this one is.
On the White House's website, you can already find a neat 45-second video explaining just why Americans need tax reform. The text reads that tax reform is pro-jobs, pro-worker, pro-American. Sound familiar?
You see us a lot of the same U.S. first and U.S. workers first type messaging that Donald Trump pushed during his presidential campaign.
Messaging that worked, says Rob Wheeler, a sociology professor at Stanford University. Because the tax code is so wonky, Republicans are also focused on keeping the framing simple, says Kathleen Jamison, a communications professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
A lot of people are going to hear that this is good for me. There are benefits here.
And she says the Democrats' message will sound more like this.
Tax breaks for the wealthy, no real tax reform that's meaningful, and balloon the deficit.
The parties will also choose different words to talk about the same thing, she says. When you look at the text of the plan, there is a line that says the death tax will be repealed, which impacts people with big inheritances. It's something the Democrats call an estate tax.
There's an instance in which very effective framing, death tax as opposed to estate tax, increases the likelihood that people say, right, you should get rid of that.
But Rob Willer says, according to his research, most people will trust the framing of their party. They're not going to be the ones to fact check all the claims.
It's going to be a handful of wonks and policy institutes.
As we get closer to a vote in Congress, you can expect all of the messages and responses to them to just get louder. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, traders mostly like what they saw in that GOP tax plan. We will have the details when we always have the details.
I think small business will benefit better. And as a whole in the community, smaller businesses are the ones that need that.
If what they say is true, that we are the businesses in the United States are the highest in the world, then we can't compete if they don't lower them. If they lower them, from what I understand, then they'll bring back a lot of money that's overseas.
That was Michael Dauda there from Arkansas, Robert Fink. He was from New York. Any discussion of the tax code and changes thereto necessarily gets complicated, and we have now arrived at that point in the broadcast. I'm sorry to have to tell you. One of the key elements in the plan as outlined today on the individual side is doubling what's known as the standard deduction. Deductions, whether you're itemizing or taking the standard one, reduce your taxable income. So doubling anything means people who typically take the standard deduction could have less taxable income. Life would be simpler for a lot of taxpayers, yes, but with the tax code, oh no, nothing is simple. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains the standard deduction ripple effects.
The tax code is like an unwieldy, complicated, some would say rusty machine. Twist knobs over here, like the standard deduction, and over in another part of the tax code, strange things start to happen. Remember, you choose which to take, the itemized deduction or the standard deduction. So,
if doubling the standard deduction makes mortgage interest and charitable contributions less tax preferred, you might see a hit to those industries.
John Brooks teaches at Georgetown's law school. If people do better by taking the larger standard deduction instead of itemizing, he says, they won't have the same tax incentives to give their money to the local food bank or to buy a bigger house. Some won't do those things. And we're talking about lots of folks losing those incentives. According to estimates from the Tax Policy Center, some 38 million filers who would have itemized would opt for the new higher standard deduction. That's 84% of all itemizing filers. If the number of people who itemize does drop dramatically,
those of you who are rejoicing that the mortgage interest deduction has been saved and the charitable contribution deduction has been saved may, you know, take a cold shower.
Edward McCaffrey is a law professor at USC.
Because while they've been saved today, their vulnerability has been heightened.
Because next time around, he says, there will be far fewer people complaining about those levers getting pulled and knobs getting turned. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
There are, in the broadest sense, two parts of the Republicans' plan for the tax code. Individual tax rates and brackets, and then the corporate tax code, the most significant bit of which has come to be called repatriation. The tax code says American companies under current law have to pay a 35% corporate rate on foreign profits they bring home, though in practice, there are, of course, loopholes. Congressional Republicans in the White House want that money repatriated, the theory being that money inside the American economy instead of out would boost investment and create jobs here. But as we have seen in the past, how those companies actually do spend that money once they get it back is a whole nother story. Marketplace's Amy Scott has it.
$2.6 trillion with a T dollars. That's how much cash U.S. companies like Apple, Citigroup, and Nike are estimated to have stockpiled abroad to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Chris Edwards is an economist with the Cato Institute.
Right now, we have sort of a fence around the U.S. economy that deters companies from bringing their profits back home.
The idea is first to lower that fence and then transition to a system where foreign profits aren't taxed by the U.S. at all. The government has tried something like this. A one-time tax holiday in 2004 brought in an estimated $300 billion. Economist Dhamika Dharmapala at the University of Chicago Law School studied what happened.
The repatriations under the holiday did not seem to lead to increased domestic investment and employment, and were reflected mostly in share repurchases.
That's right. Rather than invest in new factories or R&D, companies bought back their own stock or paid dividends to their shareholders. Economist Kimberly Clausing at Reed College expects the same thing to happen again.
The win for those at the top, but neutral effects on investment, and I wouldn't expect any positive effect for American workers.
A report by Goldman Sachs suggests high equity prices might make buybacks less attractive this time around. The plan's supporters say no matter how companies spend the money, as long as they spend it here, it'll be good for the economy. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I'd like to see less loopholes and then just better spending.
It seems to have all these loopholes in it that benefit some and it doesn't benefit others. So to me, it's just not fair.
That was Victoria Lindley and Ursula White, Arizona and Arkansas, respectively. Coming up.
Let us go forward with an historic reform for fairness, simplicity, and incentives for growth.
Ah, Ronnie. Sound familiar? Tax policy has been here before, gang. But first, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 56 today, about 0.25%, 22,340. The NASDAQ up 73 points, 1.1%, 6,453. The S&P 500, 10 points higher, 0.4%, 2,507. Lots of bean counters toting up the Trump administration's tax proposals today with possible tax code changes in the offing. Tax preparer H&R Block up 1.25%. Financial software company Intuit adjusted down 0.2% today. And with the mortgage interest payment deduction spared in this version of the plan, important word there, this version. Look at a couple of mortgage firms. LendingTree up 5.2%. Financial services company J.G. Wentworth down about 3.25% today. Bond prices fell. When that happens, the yield rise. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.30%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I went up to Seattle last week for a sit-down with Satya Nadella. The Microsoft CEO's got a new book out that he wants to talk about, and we have been chasing him for a while. We had a longish talk, Satya and I did, so we're going to break it into two parts today and tomorrow. There were, of course, the meet and greets.
All right, Mr. Nadella, got a crew here.
Hi. Sir Kai Rizdahl, good to see you.
Such a pleasure.
How are you?
Very
Thank you
good.
For taking the time. I really
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for coming up. And
oh, absolutely. Well, you know.
A quick once-over of his office, complete with cricket paraphernalia. He is something of a devotee of the sport.
It used to be the place where I guess Bill was here and Steve was here.
Is it in this office?
Yeah, this is the office.
I want to see the cricket ball.
Oh, man, I have multiple of them. So this is the cricket ball.
And then we got going. Satya Nadella, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, man.
You have been described, I think it was Fortune magazine, as a skinny, contemplative, questioning the world kind of guy. You write about the poetry of code and cricket in this book. How did you get this job running this company?
Look, I mean, for me, the only company that I've really known is Microsoft. I've spent 25 years of my life at this company. I'm one of those consummate insiders. And, you know, you'll have to ask someone else as to how I got this job. But the thing that I feel is that innate sense of purpose of why am I here and why this company is here and the connection between the two.
All right. So let me take a second, actually, and dig into my bag here and pull out a copy of the book, right? Since fundamentally that's why we're here. Hit refresh is the title, but the subtitle is The Quest to Rediscover Microsoft's Soul. Kind of implies this company lost its soul.
The entire metaphor of hit refresh, the browser has this beautiful logic. When you hit refresh on your browser, it doesn't replace everything. It replaces only those pixels that need to be replaced. And I think that is what I wanted to capture. You know, any company that has been successful and needs to continue to drive that success will have to drive transformation. But you have to be smart.
One of the things you're trying to do in this book is talk about your views on corporate culture. You're very, very focused on that in this book. And you say, you know, people always ask me, how you doing getting Microsoft's corporate culture changed? And you say, and these are your words, I give them what I think is a very Eastern answer. You know, we're doing fine, but we're not quite there yet because maybe we'll never be there. Which gets me to this, I suppose, kind of Eastern question. Where do you find your brain space?
That's a deep question.
Well, take all the time you want.
I think the thing that I have found inspiration in is the ability to reflect, perhaps, on my fallibilities. That's, I think, what I somehow, with a lot of trial and error, have stumbled into. So what I'm most effective when I can start recognizing the mistakes I make. And that's what gives me the impetus to be able to push and change.
What's the last semi-significant mistake you made?
I would say the realization that in many cases, customers have already chosen to work with you. And yet, you consciously or unconsciously abandon them to go work off on the new shiny object is a mistake I've made recently and in the past. And every time I made the mistake, the good part was I've been able to recognize it fast enough. It's tempting in tech to sometimes move on to the next thing, except we all need to work to help others move with us. And that's, I think, what makes Microsoft unique in that sense. And it's something that at least me as a CEO of Microsoft got to get right.
Let me run through a couple of things that are of import now in public policy that I know Microsoft has a position on, and I need to get your thoughts about. First of all, of course, is immigration and DACA. You're an immigrant. You have dealt with the intricacies of the American immigration system. You know it probably better than most CEOs. You run a global company. I'm sure there are dreamers within 100 yards of where we're sitting. Are you concerned about the current state of American immigration, the debate over immigration in this country right now?
You know, first I'll admit it's a complex topic. But that said, I am definitely gung-ho about our ability as America to work this out in a way that we can get to an immigration policy that is enlightened, that is in line with our own long-term competitive interests. But we have to do work. The Congress has to do work. We in companies will have to do our work. But absolutely, I believe immigration is what makes us stronger, more competitive, and let's stick with it.
Tax reform is item number 2 or 3 in Congress, depending on what day it is. Specifically, a substantial cut in the corporate tax rate. How important is that for you and for this company?
It's number 2 after immigration. Hmm. You know, look, for me, tax reform, I think, needs to think through what is it that we want to do in the U.S. so that we can create more of an incentive for people to invest. Quite honestly, as Microsoft, mm-hmm. that's not my number one issue. I am investing in the United States. I am, you know, we pay taxes here, we pay taxes elsewhere. If anything, what my interest would be, some global tax regime that has some equilibrium. Because I think the stability for a multinational company like ours to be able to do business world over, where we are paying taxes, we are contributing locally in every country, and we are able to invest, is what's most important.
That was part one with Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft. Part the second tomorrow. But if you can't wait that long, we have got the whole thing, as well as some bits that didn't make it on the air, into our Corner Office podcast, which is out right now.
As a person who is middle class, or I considered middle class. I don't feel so middle class anymore because of all of the tax cuts that are going to the wealthy.
The current tax code is not set up for the middle class. All it does is hurt the middle class, and the middle class funds the economy.
That was Letha Cadenette. She's from New York. Brian Flaherty, he's from Jersey. There is a word, back to taxes now, there is a word not being said out loud very much as congressional Republicans and the White House roll out their tax plan. That word is if. For all the gotta pass spin you hear people giving this thing, the fact is getting from today to a bill sitting on the president's desk is still a very big if. So if a tax overhaul does get done, it'll be the first time in a generation that has happened, 1986. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what made it possible back then.
The great tax reform of 1986 began a couple years earlier, when everyone seemed to be complaining about and campaigning on the tax code.
There became a mood in the country that the tax system in our country was not fair. It was too complicated.
Senator Byron Dorgan was a congressman in 1984 on the House Ways and Means Committee.
President Reagan campaigned on it, as did Democrats in the Congress.
Let us go forward with an historic reform for fairness, simplicity, and incentives for growth.
President Ronald Reagan, in his 1984 State of the Union, calling for the Treasury Department to study tax reform. Gene Sterley worked at Treasury on that study.
One of our tricks to get the study going was to try to build a base on those principles that that most people would hold in common.
People, meaning Republicans and Democrats. And principles like people with equal income should pay the same in taxes, or government should avoid setting up incentives that distort markets. Senator Bill Bradley was a co-sponsor of the Senate's version of tax reform. He told Marketplace Weekend senators worked from similar principles.
And the message there was something in this for everybody.
That basic openness to bipartisanship and mutual values was present at times in the House, the Senate, and the executive branch in 1984, 85, and 86 in a way that is rare today. Gene Sterley.
Right now, most of what I've seen in tax reform resembles what we saw earlier in health reform. It starts off with a set of wants. Wants are not bad, but they're not a base of principles around which you can organize real reform.
Do not imagine, though, that back in the mid-80s there was some kind of national kumbaya moment around tax reform. Senator Dorgan.
It never had robust life. You know, it always looked like it was on oxygen.
It almost fell apart numerous times.
Joe Thorndike is a tax historian with Tax Analysts, a nonprofit publisher on tax policy. Democrats were still reeling from their election loss and fighting amongst themselves. Republicans were divided on how to pay for tax reform. Both parties were miles apart from one another. But, he says,
no one wanted to be responsible for killing tax reform. You know, it was starting to develop some political momentum.
The basic framework that both Congress and the president agreed upon in its simplest version was to broaden the tax base, shut down loopholes, get more people paying taxes, in order to lower the tax rates for people generally.
The top rate drops to 28% from, it had been 50% before that for individuals. I mean, that's a gigantic drop. But in exchange for that, people gave up a lot of things.
The fact that so many interests had to give up a loophole, deducting your interest on credit card debt, for example, was in some ways a plus, Gene Sterley again.
So that if you came to me and said, you know, why are you going after my tax break? I could say, well, we went after everybody's tax break. You tell me why your special tax break should be kept.
But among all the loopholes that were closed in 86 was one in particular that made tax reform back then much easier, according to Senator Dorgan. Tax shelters were rampant at the time.
Closing that huge loophole came up with some significant revenue that allowed us then to reduce the tax rate generally. That doesn't exist today.
Tax historian Joe Thorndike says many of the other loopholes that were closed belonged to business interests, whereas today it's business taxes that are supposed to get lowered in tax reform.
The big beneficiaries in 1986 were individuals, and businesses ended up picking up the tab.
2017 is no 1986. Senator Byron Dorgan.
Most ingredients that existed in 1986 do not exist now.
And for all the successes of the 1986 tax reform, many of them were undone in the decades that followed. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I'm happy to pay taxes and to do my part, but it's too easy for the top 1% to have loopholes and to actually not pay taxes at all. And if you're that successful, maybe you should kick in a little more.
Nobody likes to pay taxes, but I am in a lucky position, so I'm more than happy to pay my taxes, and I want to see people who make more money than me pay higher taxes.
That was Scott Woolbright from Arkansas, Hannah Peterson. She is from Pennsylvania. This final note on the way out today, a brief discourse on words and how they are being applied to the issues in the American economy of late. First of all, despite what you might have heard President Trump say today,
these tax cuts are significant. There's never been tax cuts like what we're talking about.
Tax cuts and tax reform are not actually the same thing. And in fact, along those lines, whether what the GOP has in mind even is reform is very much in the eye of the beholder. Merriam-Webster defines reform like this, quote, to put or change into an improved form or condition, to amend or improve by change of form or removal of faults or abuses. What you see depends on where you sit. Words matter, gang. Words matter. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 56 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 73 points, 1.1% on tax day. The S&P 500 advanced 10 points, about 0.4%. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.